Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Michael Dorsey of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, who reviews the recent findings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change with attention to the disparate impacts of global warming on economically vulnerable populations. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace, who talks about her detention and brutalization in Egypt and the current status of U.S. relations with Egypt's military government. And Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy with the media democracy group Free Press, who talks about the coalition of groups challenging the proposed Comcast-Time Warner cable merger. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The medical charity Doctors Without Borders has blasted the United Nations for appalling conditions in a camp for displaced persons in conflict-ridden South Sudan, where nearly 1 million people have fled their homes in recent months and over 3.7 million people are at risk of hunger. Doctors Without Borders charges that the conditions for 21,000 war refugees at a camp in Tomping near the capital city of Juba demonstrate the callous indifference by UN officials. Camp residents are forced to live in flood-prone areas and experience high levels of gastrointestinal disorders, respiratory infections, and skin disease. Aid groups have repeatedly asked UN officials in South Sudan to relocate the camp to a non-flood area, but these requests have been rebuffed. The growing humanitarian crisis in South Sudan, the world's newest nation after seceding from Sudan in 2011, has led UN relief agencies to call on donor nations to contribute $230 million in emergency relief funding by June. An estimated 300,000 South Sudanese refugees have fled to neighboring Ethiopia and Uganda. Conflict broke out last December between government soldiers and forces loyal to the ousted former Vice President Riek Machar. Although a ceasefire was reached between the two sides on January 23rd, sporadic fighting has continued. Over the last 20 years, China's consumption of pork has doubled, and the U.S. has now become one of China's largest pork suppliers. Last fall, the Chinese company Shuangwei International bought U.S.-based Smithfield Foods for $7.1 billion, establishing one of the world's largest pork producers. According to Mother Jones magazine, U.S. pork exports to China grew 10 times over the last decade, and it is now 40% cheaper to raise pigs on factory farms in the United States than in China, largely due to lower feed costs. U.S. pork exports have risen as farmers in China are challenged by raising hogs on some of their nation's most polluted lands, which have been ravaged by rapid industrialization, leading to erosion, salinization, acidification, and widespread abuse of agricultural chemicals. Increasing Chinese demand for U.S. pork has led to growing pressure to increase factory farming methods across America, resulting in contaminated lagoons of toxic waste, antibiotic-resistant pathogens, and dangerous low-wage jobs at meat processing facilities. Across the United States, teen access to powerful prescription opioid painkillers has led to a new heroin epidemic in mostly white and suburban communities. Painkillers are often prescribed for sports injuries or dental work, but can lead to powerful addictions. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the use of heroin by people under 12 across the U.S. nearly doubled between 2007 and 2012. The death of Oscar-winning actor Philip Seymour Hoffman from a heroin overdose has led to a new media focus on the dangers of heroin abuse. The rise in painkiller addiction goes back to 1996, when the pharmaceutical giant Purdue Pharma introduced OxyContin, a narcotic similar to opium. The painkiller was originally targeted at the broader public to treat moderate pain and chronic injuries. A decade later, painkiller abuse went epidemic, and Purdue Pharma pled guilty to misleading doctors and the general public about the health risks of their drug. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, today over 12 million Americans use painkillers without a prescription, and many are using the drug to get high. Three-quarters of all drug overdoses in the U.S. are linked to powerful painkillers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has just released the third part of its every 7 years report on global warming. In their most recent climate research report, scientists predict that unless the world acts immediately to drastically cut greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels and switch to renewable energy, the atmosphere will heat up by more than 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit or 2 degrees Celsius, a level at which catastrophic changes will be inevitable and irreversible for centuries. Consequences of global warming include the complete melting of the polar ice caps, massive flooding of coastal cities, as well as droughts and desertification. The scientific panel also warned that demand for food and drinkable water could outpace supply, and that those who contributed the least to the problem, poor people living in wealthy nations and impoverished countries overall, will suffer first and most. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dr. Michael Dorsey, Interim Director of the Energy and Environment Program at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies in Washington, D.C. Originally founded to study the impact of economic and environmental policies on African Americans, the program has since broadened its research to include all marginalized people in America. Here, Dr. Dorsey explains the disparate impacts of climate change on different groups of people and points to what action should be undertaken to address and alleviate the crisis.
The first thing to understand is that those that contribute the least amount of carbon pollution to the atmosphere are, unfortunately and regrettably, those that are harmed the most from the contributions of that very same carbon pollution to the atmosphere, as well as the other host of concomitant co-pollutants. So African Americans in the United States, their emissions are about a fifth of those of wealthy white Americans in the country. Yet when we look at the effects of asthma-associated mortality, we find that African Americans are about a third more likely to die from asthma-related deaths, particularly asthma that is exacerbated by dirty or polluted air that can be exacerbated also as the average mean temperature rises. And this particular problem of the disproportionate impact of carbon pollution and its effects on particular marginalized communities in the U.S. Is a problem that faces the world. So indigenous communities in the Arctic, communities in sub-Saharan Africa, particularly poor communities in sub-Saharan Africa, in South Asia, in the high Andes, those poor marginalized communities, they are right now living out and experiencing the deleterious effects of the unfolding climate catastrophe that's gripping the planet.
Well, what do you think should happen now?
Within the climate change negotiations taking place underneath the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, there is an ongoing and active discussion on what diplomats refer to as a loss damage waiver. And this is essentially diplomatic speak for coming up with a framework to compensate communities and countries that are the hardest hit by unfolding climate change, and more specifically by catastrophic weather events that we can likely say are made worse as catastrophic climate change plays out around the world. So right now there is a desire, and it's been a long-standing desire, that countries in the global north, in the United States, in Europe, in Australia, in Canada, etc., the wealthy countries of the world that contribute much, much more carbon pollution to the atmosphere, that they need to contribute resources in proportion to the pollution that they put into the atmosphere. That's a basic principle in U.S. environmental law. It's called the principle of making the polluter pay. If you pollute excessively, you need to be fined and penalized excessively. This is something that's fundamental to U.S. environmental law. What is happening, however, is that U.S. negotiators, led by our president, President Obama, have essentially tried to water down and lower any kind of sizable monetary commitments that the United States will make to countries or other developed, rich, high-polluting countries will make to move resources quickly and in robust proportions to countries that need those resources the most. This kind of positioning is fundamentally un-American. It's fundamentally unjust.
Not to mention the Republicans, many of whom deny the existence of human-caused climate change.
You could have no more sideways and backwards views of science and of reality than those expressed by many members on the Republican side of the aisle. There are those Republicans that are rooted in reality and not in cartoonish hucksterism and charlatanism that would love to see serious steps made on environmental issues. And some of those folks are having conversations with those on the other side of the aisle. There is a dialogue amongst both right and left political positions in Washington and elsewhere about what more can be done to get out ahead of the unfolding climate crisis. And in fairness, that level of charlatanism from the Republican Party is something that the White House has to contend with.
Michael Dorsey, it seems like the world has already passed several dates which were presented by scientists as the absolute latest by which we'd need to make serious efforts to rein in greenhouse gases. I kind of think it's too late. What do you think?
Well, the question of whether or not we are beyond certain tipping points is indeed a debate that many scientists are actually having. And the real scientific debate has nothing to do with the actual existence of climate change or an unfolding climate catastrophe. The real scientific debate is more about how bad will unfolding climate change and climate catastrophe be for ecosystems as well as societies and communities. That's the real debate that's in the science. And there's a lot of evidence that indicates that we are indeed beyond certain tipping points.
That was Dr. Michael Dorsey, Interim Director of the Energy and Environment Program at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. Find more information on the recently released report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 3rd, U.S. peace activist and co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace, Medea Benjamin, flew to Egypt, where she was to join a delegation of women traveling to Gaza for International Women's Day. However, when she arrived at the Cairo airport, Medea was detained without explanation. After 7 hours of isolation, she was placed in a jail cell and held overnight. Although Medea, through her friends, had contacted the U.S. Embassy in Cairo for assistance, no one from the embassy ever arrived. In the morning, five men dragged Medea out of her cell, tackling and handcuffing her, which resulted in a dislocated shoulder, a torn ligament, and a fractured arm. Soon after, Benjamin was placed on a plane for deportation to Turkey, where she later received medical treatment for her injuries. The original purpose of Medea's trip to Egypt was to cross the border into Gaza with 100 other women solidarity activists to witness the hardships faced by 1.7 million residents there, deliver humanitarian aid, and call for peace and justice for Palestinians. But her treatment at the hands of Egyptian police has focused new attention on the repressive actions of Egypt's military government. Since overthrowing the Muslim Brotherhood government led by Mohamed Morsi in July 2013, the military has killed over 1,000 people and jailed over 16,000 and is clearly targeting anyone they view as opponents of the regime. When on March 24th, an Egyptian court sentenced 529 supporters of former President Morsi to death for the killing of a single police officer, the verdict provoked condemnation from international human rights groups. Despite the ongoing repression, on January 15th, the U.S. Congress restored more than $1.5 billion in military and economic aid to Egypt that had largely been frozen after the military overthrew the Morsi government. Your reporter spoke with Medea Benjamin, who talks about her detention and brutalization in Egypt and the current status of U.S. relations with Egypt's military government.
Yes, I was detained. I was beaten up. I was violently arrested and deported, and I still suffer the pain from the physical injury, but it did put me in touch with people around the country who are working on over 1,000 cases of people killed by this present government, the 16,000 plus people that are in jail because of their political beliefs, the ongoing abuses in those jails, the 529 people who've just been sentenced to death for the alleged killing of one policeman in a totally ridiculous sham trial, and the way the U.S. government has refused to call it a coup, and we are afraid that the government is going to open the spigot on U.S. aid to the military in Egypt again. So in a sense, the silver lining was to have become more aware, sensitive, and connected to the terrible abuses going on in Egypt and become part of a broader community that's trying to do something about that.
As I understand it, there was attempts by, if not yourself directly, then your friends and allies to get the U.S. Embassy involved at the time where you were still in Egypt, being incarcerated at the airport. And I'd read one account that basically said the U.S. Embassy's response in Cairo was that, hey, you're on your own, which doesn't sound like the normal response of, the embassy to U.S. citizens who are in a predicament like you were. What do we know about the U.S. Embassy and possible collusion with the Egyptians on this?
You know, it's still a mystery to me. I was there for 17 hours and never heard a peep from the U.S. Embassy, despite contacting them, having friends in Cairo contact them, my colleagues at home calling them constantly. I finally got one message that they were on their way. They'd be there in 10 minutes, and then hours later, they never showed up. Now, I wrote a series of questions to the U.S. State Department that they were supposed to have answered by the embassy, and I've never received the answers from them. I am sure that if I were John Kerry's sister, like Peggy Kerry, and I was detained at the Cairo airport within minutes, I would be hearing from the U.S. Embassy. So who knows why? I have no answers, and I'm very upset about it.
What do you think this is a symptom of when we're dealing here with the Egyptian military dictatorship that is responsible for deaths and suppression? The United States, a longtime ally of the Egyptian military. What are the concerns you have of, beyond your own individual case, which I know you minimize compared to the other dire situations that a lot of people in Egypt currently face? But is it a window into some other concerns about how our government is interacting with what many people believe is a very despotic and toxic administration there in Egypt?
Well, I would say you kind of hit the nail on the head there, because the problem is the long-term relationships between the U.S. military and the Egyptian military, and that was happening under Mubarak, one of the ways that the U.S. propped up the Mubarak regime, and it continues today. And so you have this kind of collusion with a very corrupt military. And to see today that it seems that John Kerry is looking for an excuse to be able to say, oh, Egypt is moving towards democracy. Look, they had a constitutional referendum. Look, they are going to have elections, and these elections are going to be totally ridiculous elections with the former Minister of Defense resigning his position so that he could run in the next presidential elections. I mean, there should be an outcry from our government right now saying that's ridiculous. In a democracy, the leader of the coup would not be running in elections that everybody knows is already rigged in his favor. When you don't have freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, even at this point, you don't have basic freedoms, how can you have free and fair elections? So, yes, it's a terrible problem that the U.S. military and I would say the Obama administration continues to want to curry favor with the Egyptian military, partly because of the relations with Israel and the Camp David Accords, partly because of the military-industrial complex that sells so many weapons to the Egyptian government, and partly because of the Suez Canal. All of those reasons, I would say.
That was Code Pink Women for Peace co-founder Medea Benjamin, author of the book Drone Warfare: Killing by Remote Control. She is the recent recipient of the Gandhi Peace Award from the group Promoting Enduring Peace. For more information on the human rights situation in Egypt and Code Pink actions, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. We'll be right back. In the debate over the proposed $45.2 billion Comcast takeover of Time Warner Cable, there is much at stake, both for consumers and media diversity. Opponents of the deal point out that a future marriage between Comcast, the nation's number one cable and internet company, and number two Time Warner would create a giant communications corporation that would dominate two-thirds of the country. A coalition of consumer and public interest groups, including Free Press, Common Cause, Consumers Union, and the Working Families Party, assert that approval of the Comcast-Time Warner merger would be anti-competitive, anti-consumer, and result in higher prices for cable and internet service. Together, the groups collected 400,000 petition signatures opposed to the deal and turned them into the Federal Communications Commission and the Department of Justice, the two government agencies responsible for approving or rejecting the proposed merger. While more than 100 lobbyists hired by Comcast are roving the halls of Congress advocating for approval of the merger, there are more than a few skeptics. During a recent Senate judiciary hearing on the proposal, Democratic Senator Al Franken of Minnesota expressed his strong opposition, saying the megadeal threatens competition and could spike consumers' cable rates. Your reporter spoke with Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy with the media democracy group Free Press. Here he talks about the coalition of groups challenging the proposed Comcast-Time Warner merger and the consequences for consumers should the deal be approved.
What's unusual in some respects about this merger is that their coverage is in different parts of the country. When cable franchises set up around the country, they negotiated franchise agreements with cities that gave a lot of them exclusive monopoly control of that local marketplace. So if you're in one part of the country, you may have Comcast as your cable internet provider. If you live, you know, on the other side of the state, you might have Time Warner Cable there, but they don't compete with one another. They've purposefully staked out territory, but when you combine them, you have then one company that has the potential to reach two-thirds of the American geography they would have. They would be providing truly high-speed internet access to nearly 50% of the marketplace in the United States. So it would become this colossus that really not only controls access to cable television and access to high-speed internet services, but can combine those two elements to really control the future of all communications in the United States. And that's why Free Press, my organization, and dozens of other groups have spoken out so vociferously about this merger.
Maybe you could speak about the consequences for consumers of this merger if it were to be approved by the federal government, and you know what we know about the consolidation of media, you know, in terms of cable service and the other services these companies provide.
We've learned a lot from what the future would look like under a powerful Comcast from what the past has looked like. And Comcast has a record of raising rates to consumers at several times the rate of inflation over the last decade. The charges for your cable service and your internet service have gone up at a very high level. And even when the top lobbyist for Comcast, a fellow by the name of David Cohen, was asked about whether this merger meant that prices would start leveling out or even going down, he said very frankly that he didn't think that was going to happen, that the prices will continue to go upwards. And with the lack of competition in the marketplace, they will be able to dictate those terms. One of the things that's happened over the last couple of years as more people use broadband, high-speed internet, where we've gone from dial-up to DSL, and now people even want faster than DSL, their choices have become more limited. It used to be the idea was that the telephone companies, AT&T and Verizon, would compete with the cable companies to give you high-speed internet access. But since the telephone companies have largely gotten out of the business of providing that level of internet access, if, for example, Verizon, which services parts of the Northeast, has decided that it's not going to continue to build out its fiber high-speed internet network, the choices have become even less for consumers. And now you really, you know, if you want high-speed internet services, you're pretty much limited to your cable provider. So if you have Comcast controlling the bulk of that business in the United States, and given their track record on pricing, I think you have a problem where a lot of Americans may not be able to afford the sort of high-speed internet services that we think are important for the continued economic development of this country.
Well, up against these lobbyists is a lot of citizen activists, including your group and a coalition of other organizations across the country. Tell our audience a bit about what you're doing to try to block this merger.
Well, Free Press doesn't have the sort of money that Comcast has to buy up influence in Washington. And what we do is traditionally organize on the outside. That's, we organize people beyond the Beltway to voice their concerns about this merger at the FCC and at Congress. And we've submitted 400,000 letters from people around the country protesting this. And we also have been organizing a lot of groups, not just media democracy groups like Free Press, but consumers' rights groups, groups that are concerned about free speech on the internet, that are concerned about access, that are concerned about universal access in internet services, that are concerned about prices. And we're going to keep on trying to win the debate in the public eye, the war of ideas, and make sure that the American public has an opportunity to say what they think about this merger. And I think there was a recent poll, I think it was done by Reuters, that showed that a majority of Americans didn't think that this merger would serve the marketplace in any productive way. So we want to kind of build on that consensus and make sure that before they make a decision at the Department of Justice and before they make a decision at the Federal Communications Commission, that they've heard from those Americans who think this merger isn't a good idea.
That was Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy with the media democracy group Free Press. Find more news and analysis on the proposed Comcast-Time Warner merger by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.